seen anything like that.
I'm a very confident front runner for Caddy for 33 years, 145 wins now, and that's the best win I've ever had.
I have no idea what you have.
I don't know. How are we going to count all the shots? I can't keep track.
Fuck! God damn it!
I don't think he's pleased.
Of course you would. That's a particularly stupid question. It's the Irish Open. Of course you want to play at the weekend.
You're welcome along to Golf Weekly. We are looking back at just about the most extraordinary Open we've seen in some time, or certainly since last year. That's the way the Opens have tended to go of late. We are luxuriating in the brilliance of one Jordan Spieth. Coming up, we'll talk to Peter Lawrie, who'll give us his take on just how Spieth managed to hold it all together when it looked for all the world like he was about to blow up quite badly, but he pulled it back somewhere between the 13th driving range and the 14th. Fionn Davenport is not here, but he is in Manchester. Hello.
Hey, Joe.
Wow, crystal clear from Manchester.
Yeah.
You're in Media City, I understand.
I am. Over where the BBC, where Carnation Street is made, where all these budding media entrepreneurs have set up shop in the hope of transforming the North into a place that reminds people across the world that there is life in England beyond London.
So that's Salford there where you are then?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so where Five Live, all the BBC radio is?
Exactly, yeah. I can, well, not quite. If I look out the window and look around the building, I can see where Five Live are.
Wow. Is it just Five Live that moved up, or did all the BBC stations move?
No, Breakfast are there. Oh, in terms of radio, yeah.
Stations.
Five Live is there.
Okay.
But they
BBC,
also...
BBC 1 through to 4 is back in London still.
Yes, and but they have BBC TV, so Breakfast is made here. All of the sports is here.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. I used to be a big Richard Bacon fan when he was in Five Live, and he was, he was funny. He refused to even pretend that he hated the fact that Five Live had moved to Manchester, because he has a house in London, family in London.
I know.
He would literally get the train up and down most days.
We were talking, actually, the lads outside here, and we were just having this conversation about, like, it was... You know, it's rare enough for any media company to get a chance to start something from scratch. So you build new buildings, you can put in all brand new technology. But like a lot of the systems that are in the BBC are kind of old school, you know, old school tech. And we were wondering if that was the case. Is like, it's hard enough to convince all these people to kind of go north of the Watford Gap. And Weather says, look, there is, it's the same technology you're familiar with in London. We've installed it here because, as you say, it is. It was a massive, massive, massive thing. And it's compared. Do you remember the Irish government thought about decentralizing all of its departments? And there was this whole plan about people, the Department of Education moved to Athlone and they were going to disperse, and it didn't really happen.
Yeah. Mm. Well, Bacon really wasn't too worried about the technology. He just absolutely hated the fact that he couldn't be in London.
And yet Manchester is way superior to London.
Yeah, it's not, though. Small.
Yeah, but it is charm. Because I'm here.
Oh,
so.
Sure. No, yeah, you've chosen to live. Amazing. Yeah.
Sorry, I'm not saying it's better because of me, but because I'm here, I'm going to declare that it's better.
Yeah, you have to tell yourself that.
Exactly.
Well, actually, that theme of self-delusion and knowing self-delusion. No, work with me here. That theme of knowing self-delusion will be part of a clip of Jordan Spieth we're going to play very shortly.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, yeah. We'll come back to it and you'll know what I mean. He does quite an extraordinary thing and he talks about it in the press conference. So, Jordan Spieth, just remarkable. I'll get to some tweets first. Nick Gordon sent a picture 8 hours ago. I just think sometimes when I'm heading into work, it crosses my mind occasionally, God, there's people out there now having great rounds of golf and I'm not. Because, you know, so often we might play in a midweek and I think, oh, those poor suckers in work.
Yeah.
So Nick Gordon took a picture outside the Sunningdale clubhouse enjoying 36 holes at Sunningdale, hashtag friend of the pod.
Oh, good.
Disgusting. That's how he spent his day today.
Yeah, but what kind? Did he have two good rounds, did he say? Did he play well?
Doesn't matter.
No, no, true.
It doesn't. Did you see the Paul Kimmich piece with Paul McGinley recently?
No.
McGinley was talking about his TV punditry and he was saying that one of the things he's trying to improve is his command of the English language. And he talked about how he will spend a lot of time at Sunningdale with the Eton boys trying to watch how they use language. Study it.
Very interesting. He's is it to his everlasting credit that Paul McGinley is very aware of his deficiencies and is not afraid to confront them head on and say, I'm going to improve in this. Because it would be so easy for him, given the stature that he has in the administration of golf, to just coast on that reputation. But he wants to improve. I mean, I think it's to his credit. I don't know that hanging around with Eton boys is going to make your English any better,
yeah,
or make you just sound like a pain in the ass tough. But that he wants to improve is good.
It is.
Says he. And I'm conscious about how good is my English?
It's okay. I understand, yeah, what you're saying most of the time. Paul Kimmage didn't react well. Eton boys, David Cameron arseholes, was kind of Kimmage's reaction, which is, yeah, pretty funny. Sean Doolin, oh yes, sent a picture of Spieth on the putting range. Putting green, rather, the range. I saw Spieth on the putting green, lads. I planned and sent for 5 minutes. 30 minutes later, I was still there. It was almost hypnotic. Said Doolin. Reminds me of Colin Byrne, caddy now to Rafa Berabello, who was on off the ball maybe a year or two ago, and he was saying that Spieth was similar to Doolin there, hypnotic to watch, and it was the phrase he used was, he's the only putter where every time he puts, it scares the hole. Never, yeah, you know, he said most other players, you see them and they get up out of the putt early, or they, you just know it's not going in. Where Spieth, you always think, ooh, is this about to go in?
It's Tiger Woods at his absolute best.
Yeah. Funny, the one time Spieth has got out early of a putt that really stands in my mind was at Birkdale, when it was right in the midst of all the collapse. He had a terrible putt from a few
feet.
Yeah,
yeah.
And got straight up out of it.
Yeah.
Derek Hayes then, how awkward was it watching Clark and McGinley in studio together? I thought it was okay, to be honest.
Oh, I thought it was awkward.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I mean, I don't mean awkward like that they were throwing each other daggers or anything like that, but like, at one point, was David Livingstone sitting between them or Butch was sitting between them?
Butch always in the middle though, isn't he not?
Yeah, but there was definitely, like, yeah, I mean, or maybe we're reading into it because we all know that there's been a bit of bad blood, yeah, over the Ryder Cup between them. So we read into their body language that these two guys are not, I'm not saying that they don't like each other, but they're not that comfortable being in each other's company.
McGinley talked about it in the Kimmage piece, which was last weekend as well. And he was saying, we're now at a point where, I think the way he described the relationship was, if I walked out of the building right now and Darren Clark was coming in, would we stop and have a chat? Yeah. So... That's never the warmest way to frame a relationship.
No, it isn't.
Draft Helping said, okay, so here's an interesting point. And we can tease this out a bit more later. But hi, I missed most of the Open. I'm struggling to see what was so extraordinary about Spieth on 13. Poor drive, half decent bogey, he says. For the record, his 5-under for the last five holes was extraordinary, he says in capitals. I'm just not overwhelmed by what was a decent escape on the 13th. And I suppose...
We'll talk about it.
Yeah.
We'll explain exactly why it was absolutely remarkable.
Yeah. Tristan Gerd, Matt Kuchar deliberately calling it the British Open after the BBC interviewer would call it the Open, not once but twice. Andy Hoskins, oh my God, the picture he sent. I retweeted it from the Golf Weekly account. Sat listening to @GolfWeeklyNT while enjoying my morning tea from a water villa? Via? V-I-L-A?
What's it? Okay.
I don't know what that is. But it's
from Waterville?
No, from a water villa.
Oh, okay. I don't know.
Or maybe he's left out an L and he means just a water villa because it looked like he was floating on water, the house was.
Ah, nice.
Oh, yeah, okay. While on honeymoon in the Maldives.
Oh, please. Did you notice, just about the British Open nonsense, but did you notice that, I know Sarah Sturk did it a couple of times.
I've now started calling it the Great British Open.
But that they're on message.
I texted Malachy Clerken last night to come on. Today, and I said, do you want to come on and talk with me and Fiona about the Great British Open?
And what did he say?
He didn't acknowledge that I'd done that.
But that they're obviously on message. So it's now, it's the Open Championship, and yeah, they consciously said it a few times, which reminded me of, and I wonder if it's to do with like maintaining rights, that the RNA are insisting that that's what it's called. And so they lay down the law to Sky, just as fans at Augusta are not fans, they're patrons, and Sky, you know, bend the knee in such an obsequious manner as to make me want to just be annoyed while I'm watching it on television and then forget about it when it's over.
I didn't really notice they were on message. I mean, I call it the Open too.
I know, but that's because, yeah, but if I don't care if Matt Kuchar calls it the British Open, and I don't think anyone should care.
No, I'm with you there. But equally, I don't think Sky are quite at the point of, if they're interviewing Matt Kuchar and he calls it the British Open, I don't think they're quite there where they're saying, just to clarify, Matt.
No, but Now, a listener could correct me here. I was under the distinct impression, it wasn't Matt Kuchar, I can't remember who it was, who mentioned the British Open. And then in the next sentence, Sarah Sturt goes, and when you come to the Open Championship.
Oh, I don't know. I didn't notice that. By the way, I haven't even mentioned, so Nathan Murphy and Dave McIntyre, neither of whom available today.
Yeah.
Nathan is away. I'm not sure where he is. I know McIntyre's abroad, certainly on holidays. But they're, neither of whom are here. So you've made incredible efforts to get to Media City in Manchester.
I did, all the way from Stockport.
So they're your tweets. At Golf Weekly NT is where you get us. We are reflecting on the Open next. We will have Peter Lawrie's thoughts, by the way, coming up. We'll talk to Peter. What he made of it all, and that is on the way. But Fionn, you and I will begin to digest just the most extraordinary of opens. The 146th Open at Birkdale felt pretty iconic around the time Spieth was going through 15-16 after everything which had unfolded over the previous 2 hours. Mm. This was, I mean, I always say to people, I think one of the many amazing things about golf is that you can have heightened drama over such a prolonged period of time. Like in football, which I also adore, a penalty shootout is amazing drama when the stakes are high. But you know, it lasts for about 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And most other sports, the last 3 minutes of a game, Manchester United winning the Champions League, GAA hurling, it's very rare. I think it's unique to golf that you can have that heightened tension for about 2 hours.
Oh, absolutely. I'm just curious, you were working on Sunday, so how much opportunity did you get to sit and focus on what was happening? I mean, I know you were keeping an eye on it, but you were presenting. Whereas, so I'm at home on the couch and I start off, and no pundit, not one, suggested for a second there was a possibility that Spieth was going to do anything other than just walk to victory, maybe shoot one under, but that he was going to keep everybody at arm's length, that Matt Kuchar, though laudable his effort was, just he didn't really have the game. He was going to miss too many putts. He was never really going to challenge. That was the message. And I sat down fully expecting this. And I was kind of convincing myself that because I like Jordan Spieth, I'm going to be interested in this. But frankly, I was kind of setting myself up for a bit of a bore fest. Yeah. That it was just going to be.
And
so cut to five holes. But I'm on the couch and I felt pain in my stomach. So much so that Laura comes in and I was like effing and blinding.
Have we gone from referring to her as your girlfriend to Laura?
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Yeah. See, my girlfriend, Laura, comes in and she goes, what's the matter? And I was like, ugh. Spieth is doing this. He's blowing up. He is absolutely having the biggest meltdown. And I sat on the couch and I was like, I can't watch this. I can't watch this.
It was upsetting.
It was, for me, anyway, as a fan.
We were the same. I mean, we were trying to preview it at several points. We had Rex Hoggard on the show, who's obviously on the podcast a fair bit, and we had Shane Ryan on as well. And even like, you know, even a hole or two or three in when Spieth was beginning to put a bogey or two together, even then, we, I think it was Shane Ryan I was talking to at that point, we were, I felt like we were trying to play up the fact that this could be a very close run thing. You know, even a bogey or two in, we were still saying, you know, like he could really blow this. And we're like, I guess he could. But do you think he will? No. And no, I don't either. And there was, there was an inescapable sense for the whole morning and afternoon that Spieth was just going to see this through. Kuchar wasn't good enough. And that Spieth is, you know, can kind of come through anything. Now, ultimately, he proved that he can really come through anything. But you just felt that there was no way he could lose this.
And I think, I mean, we'll get to it in a second, but I think that you're right. I think Spieth proved that he can get through things that we didn't think it was possible for any golfer to get through. Yeah. Certainly that would be my read. That, yeah, you can have, like, you can have, you know, you can throw in a couple of bogeys and then rally. But it's the little, like, I don't think I'm exaggerating, or maybe I am, just a little bit, but that he was at war with himself for the first 13 holes. You know, and he's a very verbal player anyway, but like this is crap, you know, and this frustration that he couldn't get his swing to relax, you know, the hands on his head. It was but when he stepped away from the two putts, you know, he lined and then he just stepped away. You mentioned earlier on, he missed that little tiddler. Like that, all of that, I I just was looking at him going, is it the 12th? Is it what happened at Augusta? Now, mind you, in fairness, he did rally from the 12th at Augusta and did quite well, not well enough. But I thought, this is it. This is gone. He's gone.
When I saw him missing the putt, so here's where I started to think, oh God, maybe, was when he was missing those putts. And at that point, it suddenly hit me, you know, something we had talked about in the build-up to the tournament, which was Speed this year has not been shooting the lights out on the greens. He has been 36 strokes gained for putting and has actually just been excellent tee to green. His iron play has been much improved. He's picked up a few yards off the tee in the last few years. And so it suddenly hit me, maybe under the most severe of pressure, which is a Sunday at a major, it's at that moment, and we've seen it happen to so many players before, I thought maybe it's at that moment that whatever slight weakness you've had in your game in the weeks and months before the tournament, that's when it gets exposed under that kind of pressure. And that's where I suddenly thought, my God, maybe his putting, which has been a bit dicey this year by his standards, that's going to unravel here. And obviously, you know, it didn't. I mean, like the 13th, so the tweet they're saying, why is the 13th so extraordinary?
Do you want to have a stab at it and then?
Well, I mean, in short, I would say the 13th was so extraordinary because it happened on the Sunday of an Open when he was unraveling. If he had managed that miraculous escape on a Thursday at a regular PGA Tour event, then from a technical point of view, none of the shots he would have hit were like mind blowing. There would have been a funny novelty value to being in the driving range and all the messing around with the trucks. And I think on a Thursday at a regular PGA Tour event, if he was trying to find that line, you know, line of sight with the hole or whatever, and in and out of the trucks and the rules official, I think there would have been some smiles and a, gee shucks, this is just all a bit silly, isn't it? And who knows, maybe he would have attempted to play out initially just to keep things moving. I don't think he would have taken 25 minutes. And that's, you know, that, so I understand what the tweeter is saying when he says, like, was it that extraordinary, the shots? What was extraordinary was that 23 years old, he's unraveling and somehow he keeps his cool. He keeps thinking square, you know, like even the to know, to ask, is the driving range OB?
Yeah.
So straight off, that's, you know, he's thinking really clearly there. And it's just a lucky quirk of Birkdale that the driving range is OB. And then that they didn't. They never rushed. It's just remarkable. You think, think of me and you playing when, if you're in a competition and it's going well, and then you have that inevitable hole where it starts to go awry and how easy it is to get a bit quick and just
100%
not think well. So it's probably that times 10 billion at an Open under that pressure, and you're thinking, oh my God. And the Masters is on your mind and you're thinking, have I suddenly become a choker? And so you imagine when he puts his hands on his head on the 13th tee, when he hits that shot, that he would be able to rein it all back and think so clearly and then execute the shots on an Open Sunday as opposed to a PGA Tour event Thursday. That just makes it one of the most remarkable 30 minutes I think I've seen. And you throw in the fact he's 23 years old and the last time he was in this position was the Masters.
That's okay.
My God.
All of those, everything you've just said, I wholeheartedly agree with. Greller afterwards, his caddy, he said, we've only been out here 5 years, but he's been in enough big time situations with the greatest pressure to know to slow down. Mm. Now, one other thing I'll add to the situation that you described. So this is a guy who's in full blown collapse. He's four over. Mm. He's on the verge of losing the lead for the first time.
Kuchar has a birdie putt.
Kuchar has a birdie putt. Exactly. But Kuchar also, as well, as he went, he took his iron, even though it was Spieth to play, Kuchar played just to get on the green. And he did the right thing. You know, he puts himself on the green and knows exactly what needs doing. And then he has to sit back and wait for whatever it was, 22 minutes or 18 minutes or whatever length of time it was. But so he's also on the clock. They're not on the clock, but they've been warned by John Paramore to speed up. And that was happening. And that had happened as early, I think, as the 8th. Mm. So they've been told. And so all of a sudden, in the final round of a major, okay, without having to go over everything you've just said. So all of that's happening. Mm. And John Paramore, perfectly within his rights and rightly so, goes over and goes, lads, you've got to pick up the pace here. Yeah. You're 1.5 holes behind the second last group.
Yeah, that's an extra shot of anxiety.
100%. And as Paul McGinley pointed out in commentary, yeah, he's dead right. He's going, it's unfair to the other golfers. Like, you should not have that extra advantage, even allowing for the fact that you're leading in the final round of a major. Certain allowances are going to be made. Like, you're not going to be put on the clock straight away.
Yeah.
You're just going to be told, guys, you got to speed this up. So all of this is happening on the 13th. And he hits, for anyone who's lived under a rock over the last week and a half, he hits this wild, wild shot, 120 yards right. And I mean, the idea that one is they don't know the yardage. They have no yardage. And I thought it was brilliant, the debate between the two of them over what the yardage was.
Yeah.
Is it 270? Is it 230? You know, and
I have Greller's retelling of that here.
Okay.
So he said, I walked up there, he means to the top of the dune, and he said, I tried to do the yardage in my head, and I thought I was somewhere around 270 to the front. This is Spieth talking. So
yeah,
here's Spieth's account. I walked up there and I tried to do the yardage in my head, and I thought I was somewhere around 270 to the front. Michael was like, buddy, you're 230 to the front. Somewhere around there. And Michael told me, no 3-wood, hit the 3-iron. No 3-wood, hit the 3-iron. Spieth says, if you asked me who is the better yardage, myself or Michael, in a lot of situations when we're on a crazy angle, I would pick myself. And you know what? I think every golfer would trust themselves almost. But he says, crazy angle, I'd always pick myself. And on that one, he seems very confident. He was very adamant about what club to hit, Michael, this is. And it gave me confidence to hit it. Because sometimes when that happens, I'll still go at what I think. But he was right on. And I've Bones here, who obviously was doing his making his TV commentary debut. And actually, US listeners, I'd be curious to know if how good Bones was or otherwise. But certainly from this clip, it seems like he was pretty good. So here's Mickelson's former caddy, Bones. And he was on the Golf Channel or on NBC a day or two afterwards. And he was speaking about Greller on the 13th.
I don't want to overstate this, but I think you could make the argument that that was the most critical yardage ever given to a player in the history of golf. I mean, Jordan's off the grid there. And you know, Michael has to, you know, once they find the ball, has to go to the top of that dune. He's got to eyeball it back to the ball. He's got to then eyeball it towards the green, add it up, and give it to his man with hopefully the right line. And if he gets that wrong, and that ball goes into a bunker or into a gorse bush, they are in a lot of trouble. And I think, you know, what Michael did there, his little piece, obviously he's not hitting a shot, is one of the most amazing things a caddy's ever done.
Well, that's an excellent point you make, Bones. Let's talk about the guy who did hit the shot, Jordan Spieth. You've been around some of the greatest players to ever play this game. Obviously, Phil, Tiger, you've seen him up close. You were on the back for Phil when Jordan Spieth shot 62 in 2013 at the Deutsche Bank Championship. You've seen him continue to grow. What makes Jordan Spieth special in your mind?
Well, I'll tell you a little something about what you just mentioned about that tournament where Phil was paired with him, Damon. Fred Couples had called both Phil and I that morning and wanted us to call him at the end of the day and tell us who he thought his last pick should be for the President's Cup that was going to be made very shortly after that event. And, you know, we saw Jordan play this round of golf, and we both ran off the course to our respective cars, called Fred and said, you absolutely have to pick this guy. He is something special. And more to your point, I mean, as we keep on hearing here, the size of Jordan's heart is crazy. He is able to will himself, you know, into doing these incredible things. You know, obviously, you know, after hitting the recovery shot and the pitch shot that he did there on 13 on Sunday, but then to make the putt right in the middle, go to the next hole. You know, he could have gone to that next hole and said, okay, I'm just going to get my feet underneath me here. I'm going to hit something 30 feet into the middle of the green and just work my way back into this, but not this guy. He steps up there to a back pin placement straight downwind and almost holes it.
So that's Bones with some great words, I think. And you know, I was just thinking as I played that, Greller, for a guy who's just come on the scene, it's his first experience of doing all this, like with Spieth.
Yeah.
I mean, he started playing with, you know, caddying for Spieth when Spieth wasn't a pro and then just they worked well together. And suddenly, you know, it's such a learning experience for him to go from no experience to PGA Tour and to major Sundays very, very quickly. What he has, I mean, I know he's a philosophical guy and sometimes he puts up really well-written, thoughtful Facebook posts. So he's clearly intelligent, thoughtful kind of character. He also has presence. Like
yeah,
if I said to you, because I don't know, what does Matt Kuchar's caddy look like?
Yeah.
Because you were watching them both for 5 or 6 hours.
Yeah.
But you should have seen Kuchar's caddy about as much as Greller. And you know, I could list off numerous players. Like, would you know what Jason Duffner's caddy's like? There's some that you do, clearly. Some of them have presence.
Greller has real
presence.
Well, he's also good looking. He's a handsome dude.
He's a very striking, beautiful man, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, in the end, he's a handsome guy. I think you made a point earlier on, okay? So, you're in the, like, the pressure on Spieth is certainly unquantified. Well, it's hard to quantify.
Yeah.
In that moment, you're talking about trusting your caddy. Like, it's all well and good when you're having a debate in the middle of a round where you go, you know what, play the 7-iron. And he goes, no, I'm actually feeling the 8. And you can have that debate and go, okay, I'm going to trust you. But in unbelievable pressure, the natural tendency for the vast majority of human beings is to rely, they become incredibly self-sufficient in that moment. You don't trust others. You become totally about, no, I know what I feel, I know what's going on. And it's very hard to see beyond the prism of your own specific experience. So for him to say, you know what, actually I'm looking at, he seems really sure of I'm going to trust him.
Yeah.
And I'm going to go with the 3-iron instead of the 3-wood.
Yeah.
One, that says they have an amazing relationship as a caddy player. Two, it also speaks to Spieth's ability to recognize whatever's happening with me, I'm also in the middle of something else.
Yeah.
And to be able to kind of make those decisions in spite of whatever he must have been feeling in the moment.
It's true. And so let's hear from Spieth then. And so another point to mention here before you hear this clip, which will tie in with your self-delusion about Manchester, but also Spieth in the week before the tournament had been at Cabo San Lucas. I dare say you probably hung out there. Do you know Cabo San Lucas? Have you been there?
Cabo is in, it's where all like the...
Spring break
guys go. Yeah.
But have you specifically been in Cabo?
No, I've never been to Cabo. It's in Baja, California.
Call yourself a travel writer.
So yeah, I know.
He was playing golf there the week before with Jordan and Phelps, Michael Jordan and Michael Phelps. They were hanging out.
Of course he was.
This is how it works, you know?
Yeah, I know.
And Greller on the 7th tee. So it's not like this worked instantly, to say the least. But Spieth was saying, Greller was saying to him, do you remember that group you were with in Cabo last week? You belong in that group. This was on the 7th tee, says Spieth. We walked off the tee box and Greller, Michael, made me come back. He said, you're the caliber of those athletes, but I need you to believe that right now because you're in a great position in this tournament. This is a new tournament. We start over here.
Whoa.
Now, if he'd said that walking off 13, it would have been amazing. But, you know, it didn't quite kick in just there. But Jordan and Phelps and that sense of belief.
Yeah, it
comes up here with Spieth in his press conference. So here's some of what he was saying afterwards.
Boy, this was eventful. I told Michael and I told Jay after the round, I said 17 pars and a birdie would have been fine too. But, you know, there's a lot of roads to get there. And today was I was put in a tough one early on and showed some resiliency and owe a lot of credit to my guy on the bag for that, because as you can imagine, thoughts come in from my last scenario when I was leading a major on Sunday and never mentioned it, but you know, it's all of a sudden it's creeps into your head. Wow. You know, I was so confident and all of a sudden the wheels have kind of come off everything. And how do we get back on track to salvage this round and just give yourself a chance at the end?
Well, the putt on 13 was just massive. Going two down, and not even two down, but into a tie for second. And thinking, man, I'm 5 over. You know, I mean, that was crossing my mind. When I hit the tee ball, I was put my hands over my head thinking, oh boy, as I'm walking up, this could be 6. And all of a sudden, it doesn't change in one hole. You know, he's now leading. He gets to play safe, and you have to. When that putt went in, I was really, really obviously excited, but I was walking off the green and Michael said, hey, you know, he held me up and he goes, that's a momentum shift right there. Michael Jordan and Michael Phelps are the greatest to ever do what they did, and I'm not. But if you believe that you are, then you're almost as good as being that.
Self-awareness to a T, eh?
And also a brilliant chink in the "aw shucks, who me" armor that Jordan Spieth has endeared himself to all, or a lot of golf fans, that there was a moment where he was like, yeah, I'm not Jordan or Phelps. I mean, but, you know, I kind of believe I could be.
Yeah.
I thought that was very nice.
If you believe you are, it's almost as good as being.
It's almost as good as being.
Yeah, in that headspace. And like, so it's amazing, really, like the self-knowledge to.
Amazing. Amazing.
To say, well, I'm not Jordan Phelps, because he's not. You know, this is not golf from another planet that we're seeing. It's not as dominant or scary as Tiger Woods, the most recent example. But, and he understands that, but he understands the power of mindset.
But he does. Absolutely. I earlier on said, at the risk of hyperbole, what happened on 13 and then what it led to thereafter to make that 7-footer for bogey, I think is the difference between him cementing a destiny as a serial choker and becoming a golf Jedi. I am absolutely convinced that that's the case.
I disagree totally.
You do? Go on.
I really do. I think Jordan Spieth could have choked on Sunday. I think he could choke at the USPGA. And I think he could be going into the Masters next year leading. And I'd still fancy him to get it done.
You think you do?
I think he's impenetrable. I think if he chokes...
Well, if he chokes at three majors, then he's clearly not impenetrable.
I would still back him in the fourth if he was leading on the Sunday. I think he has the ability to process it, make sense of it, and go again. Well, I really do. I think this guy is just... when I say impenetrable, I mean he will never go.
Yeah.
He will never go away. If he chokes in the next seven, I'll think he'll win the eighth.
Okay, well, here's the thing. Thankfully, we'll never know.
Yeah.
But I suppose I just think that, like, who knows? Like, these things become your destiny after a while. The scar tissue that comes from,
sure.
No matter how, I just think that, it was an incredibly decisive moment, I think. And look, the run he goes on, he's 5-under then for the closing six holes. And, like, it's the best. I mean, Nathan texted our little WhatsApp group and thinks that the putt on 15 is the greatest putt he's ever seen. And for obvious reasons, like, you know, to hit a million footer for eagle. But I still would say that the 7-footer for bogey on 13.
Oh, yeah.
It's not the greatest putt I've ever seen. I think Tiger to force the playoff with Mediate, I think, is for me the best putt I've ever seen. But yeah, it's up there. It goes back to the point, and I'm going to hold on to the fact that I think that it defined. I think it was a destiny defining putt.
I'm going to throw in Harrington in 07 to force that playoff and rescue
just
the worst bogey ever as a contender. See, it's a funny thing though. I really do think you have to believe in destiny for destiny to be able to affect you.
Sure.
And
okay.
And Spieth is just too smart to let any of that affect him.
So I'm clearly not smart enough, but like it would be, I would carry the scar tissue. In fact, it would ruin me. It would destroy me. The other thing
I think the Masters alone would have destroyed me.
Absolutely. The 12th.
Can I put a tweet to you from Keith Darcy?
Go on.
So he asks, you know, the age old question, does Spieth epitomize drive for show, put for dough? But then he wonders, best closing 4 or 5 holes of a major by anyone?
Mickelson in 2013, maybe.
The one I thought of straight away was Nicklaus in 1986 at Augusta. And I had to look.
Oh, that was incredible.
Well, you see, people forget with Nicklaus at Augusta in 86, he wasn't really being talked about as a contender for this tournament at the turn. It was just one of the greatest back nines. I didn't watch it live, so I can't talk like this, but it seems like it was the greatest back nine we've seen. I just had a double check. So he birdies 13. If we're comparing it with Spieth, you know, fairly directly. So, Nicklaus, birdies 13, eagles 15, the famous birdie on the 16th par 3, birdie 17, which is forgotten. He follows up that birdie on 16 and an eagle on 15 with a birdie on 17, and then pars 18. It's tough to beat at 46 years old.
Absolutely. And that's, as you said, like he might have been the greatest player of all time, but, you know, he was very much yesterday's man. He wasn't a contender. He wasn't a guy spoken of as a contender. I'm going to also say, oddly enough, Greg Norman at the 1993 Open. Like, and of course, everyone knows about Faldo and 3 years later, the, you know, overturns Norman's six-shot lead. But Norman shot a 6-under-64 on the Sunday to win and upstage Faldo, oddly enough. So, like, but I think in terms of drama, because Spieth went to the, he, what he did is he hurtled towards the precipice on the front nine up to the 13th. Teetered on the precipice, and, you know, a betting man would say, oh, he's gone. He teetered on the precipice, had a look inside, and had the wherewithal to pull himself back and then accelerate in the exact opposite direction. And it wasn't as if he kind of then shot like 2 under, got himself 2 nice birdies. He shot 5 under.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever seen it.
No, so neither have I. No, it's incredible.
It just doesn't happen. Golf is too difficult a game to turn momentum to that extent.
Absolutely. Can I also say it's like,
although I guess Rory on the Thursday.
It's funny, and
impressive.
If Greller deserves an awful lot of credit for really kind of being with his man, JP also deserved a lot of credit for, you know,
Rory bleeping McIlroy.
Yeah, you're Rory effing McIlroy. And it's like, to which JP, would you not have said that to him loads of other times?
Say that
But also, I was looking, because invariably we also, recency bias and the age of Twitter and the thing we're watching in front of us. So everyone's going, that's the worst tee shot ever in the history of the majors. And I'm going, that doesn't even feature in the top 20. Well, maybe it does. But like, okay, first of all, Ian Baker Finch at the 90, I remember this, at the 1995 Open, Joe, you have been to St. Andrews, hits a tee shot off the first that goes out of bounds left on the 18th.
I can't even imagine that.
No, it's like you're a professional golfer. Like it's 140 yard long. You know, you can't miss. But I had a look. I remember this shot because it always comes up as like one of the worst golf shots ever hit generally. But it seems that everybody agrees that Tom Kite at the Belrive Country Club or Country Club in 1992, I'm going to describe it, and you should go on YouTube and have a look at this. So on the 11th, he tops a 3-wood, but he doesn't top it so it just bounces into the ground.
Oh, you know, I've seen this.
You know the one that kind of hits the fan square at the end of the tee box?
I've seen this because we had Tom Kiten off the ball recently and we were just looking at shots on YouTube, and this one is near enough the top, and The Office watched this several dozen times.
Yeah, okay, so that one. And then there's, and also as well as, in, more recently, maybe 7 or 8 years ago, Tiger in Abu Dhabi hit a drive along the ground. He hit it like 90 yards.
Yeah.
On the ground.
Sure.
Like, they're way worse. They're way worse shots. Yeah. Like, he sliced one off into the, you know, it happens, you know. But anyway, so that would be no, it's not the worst shot I've ever seen.
Jack Nicklaus, obviously, is now being compared to Spieth a lot. So, I mean, I threw it on Twitter, actually, the other day. Who's favourite to complete the career Grand Slam now, Rory or Spieth? Who's favourite to complete it first? And, you know, I guess it's hard to say, really. But Jack is being compared to Jordan because they're the only two to have 3 legs of the Grand Slam before the age of 24. Nicklaus is saying, much has been said about the fact that Jordan and I were able to win 3 legs of the Grand Slam before the age of 24. But if you look, says Nicklaus, he's won 11 tournaments and I had won 8 before 24. Even Nicklaus, the hardest man in the world to impress.
And also to acknowledge that anyone's as great as him.
Yes. Even he is saying, well, you know, Jordan's record's actually even better than mine.
There's a couple of stats. Since 2015, he's led after 14 rounds in a major. That's twice as many as DJ.
Yeah.
And 13 more than Rory McIlroy.
Yeah.
And
his consistency with regard to being in contention at these things is unparalleled at the moment, post-Tiger. Everything I'm saying here is post-Tiger.
Well, he's played 70 rounds in a major, Spieth has.
Yeah.
He spent more time on top of the leaderboard than Tiger Woods, 7, and Jack Nicklaus, only 4. I know Spieth doesn't like those comparisons, fine. But, like, it's a fact.
Yeah.
You know.
He's very uncomfortable with them. And I think, genuinely, because he just doesn't feel his game, tee to green, is anywhere in that stratosphere. I think he's slightly embarrassed by those comparisons. Not to outstat each other here, right, but just another thing just some stuff I'd mention because it's just so interesting.
Go on.
So Spieth, as a front runner, because we talk about Rory as a front runner being very good, Spieth now, on 9 of the last 10 occasions when he's had a 54-hole lead, he has seen it out. 9 of the last 10.
That's right.
The only outlier being the Masters.
Yeah.
And if you want, you know, when we were when I was doing the previews on the show on Sunday and almost trying to talk up the chances of an interesting Sunday ahead of time, the stat I was putting to the likes of Rex Hoggard and Shane Ryan was a really telling one. So since 2009, and we're talking major winners only here, guys who had already won a major.
Yeah.
When they were leading going into a Sunday, with a major already in their back pockets somewhere behind them, when they were leading going into a Sunday, only once did they manage to see it out. And that was Rory McIlroy at Hoylake. Otherwise, all these major winners leading going into a Sunday had blown it. That's quite something.
It is quite something. The Ryan Lavner on golfchannel.com, he quotes a whole bunch of stats. And so, you know, he talks about the comparison. So Spieth clearly isn't, as you say, tee to green. He's not as impressive as DJ. He doesn't have the swing of Rory McIlroy. He doesn't have the distance of Johnson, McIlroy or Day. He doesn't overpower golf courses with these immense physical traits. But, you know, he is a sublime iron player. And that's often overlooked when you think of these towering five irons that Rory can hit. Mm. Obviously, his putting, you know. But his on-course tactics, like his ability to think his way around a golf course, I would argue, is superior to McIlroy, Johnson, Day, all of them. He is way ahead of them all, and he's 23 years old. And then, as Ryan Lavner, I'll quote you because I thought it was quite well written. Other players may have a higher ceiling, more swagger, more head-turning firepower. But someday, Spieth will have what they all desire, the best resume.
Yeah.
I thought that was very good. And I can't... Now, in the afterglow of watching what we did, it's easy to kind of get all excited. But as any listener to this pod knows, all three of us have been big fans of Spieth for a very long time.
Sure.
I cannot disagree with one word of those things. And that's why he's so great.
Yeah. Because when Spieth initially came on the scene, people were looking at his swing and the chicken wing. And they're like trying to explain, like, okay, so there's the putting and we can see that, but how is he actually doing this? Because statistically, it just doesn't compare with the other top players in the world. Like, he still, okay, he drives at 290, which puts him in the top third on the PGA Tour, but for the level of dominance for a guy like looking to emulate Hogan in 2015. And people, like the pundits we talked to, ultimately came to the conclusion there is no metric, there is no measurement for golf acumen. For a golf brain, for reading a situation.
And you're dead right.
And I hope in 20 years' time somehow there is, and we see that, I think we will see that Spieth is just streets ahead of so many other players, like course management. And also, you know, we've heard his clip there, just his self-awareness, his knowledge of self, his control of self. Matt Kuchar, we should touch on before we talk to Peter Lawry. So, Kuch didn't do a whole lot wrong, really.
Two under until the 18th. Like, in that stretch where Spieth was walking away, Kuchar was two under.
Yeah.
You know, he did everything he had to do, and you can't argue with a runaway train.
I say, and I think I speak for both of us, nothing against Kuch, but thank God he didn't win. It would have just cheapened the whole thing. It would have just felt like, open.
His putts, listen, he obviously did well enough to get but his putts don't threaten the hole.
No. He never holds more than he should.
No, that's exactly it. And you know what? And all of the stuff about, like, you know, that he had to wait for ages, and Spieth was very deliberate about apologizing, you know. But Kuchar must feel the way Justin Rose felt after Sergio, you know, at Augusta. It was like, what more do you, what can I do?
Yeah.
You know?
He spoke afterwards, and I think this kind of made me like Kuchar a bit more. I'd gone off him since the Andrew Coulthard incident, I'd have to admit. That was in my back of my mind. I'm still not sure about what went on there.
Yeah.
But Kuch here was a man. He's 39 years old. I know he looks about 49. You're 40. You look better than Kuch. You look younger than Kuch.
How old is he?
39.
You're kidding me.
He's 7 years older than me.
Oh, my God. I would, if you'd said to me, oh, he's only got a couple of years before he plays the senior side of it.
No. Kuch is just, he's been middle-aged since he was 15.
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
But what you're about to hear here is someone who instantly, and this is his post-round press conference, instantly understands the rarity of these chances.
It's crushing. It hurts. And there's an excitement and a thrill to have played well, put up a battle, put up a fight. You work so hard to get to this position and to have a chance to make history and to win a championship. you don't get that many opportunities. And you know, to be this close, to you know, taste it with five holes to go, it's a hard one to sit back and take.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's hard to... I mean, look, he's watching... Like, you know the way that nowadays they have these, like, put-make percentage? They show you the number, the stat,
yeah,
before the put is made.
Yeah.
Like that eagle put on 15. What was the, what's the percentage? Was 2%, 3%, whatever it was. Like, for Kuchar to sit and watch,
yeah,
like, you know what I mean? It's like, Spieth is going to shave the hole. He's going to get it up to tap in. Although, mind you, up to that point, he wasn't getting anything to tap in distance.
Yeah.
But like, oh, you're thinking, all right, okay, he's going to make a nice birdie and... And to watch it go in. I'm sorry, I'm laughing. I have to say, I feel for him because at least he was honest enough to say it was crushing,
yeah,
and not go, oh, you know, I gave my best. I'll be back next year, which I'm sure is true. But, you know, at least he had the wherewithal, yeah, to go, yeah, you ripped the heart out of my chest.
Yeah, it's true. And like, if you're Kuchar and you're reflecting on it on the way home that night, you're thinking to your, if it's anyone other than Spieth who holds all of those puts, you're thinking,
it's his.
That is crap. That is a complete fluke. But because it's Spieth, you're thinking it's actually not a fluke. It's just frightening what he can do.
And maybe
that makes it more palatable. Like if Rory McIlroy had held those two or three months.
But he wouldn't have.
No, but I'm saying if he had, and you're Kuchar, then you'd feel even more hard done by it. You'd think to yourself, that just never happens. Like how the hell did this, you know, how did this happen to me? But when Spieth does it to you, And you watch the ball tracking all the way and hits the hole, and you know what Spieth has done over the last couple of years. You honestly look at him and you say, "Like, there's nothing I can do."
Exactly.
It's just like a force of nature. I do want to get on to Peter Lorre soon if you want to make a final point.
Yeah, sorry. I just want to make just the one point is that I have to say I really hated the odious comparisons. Sky really tried to turn this into a Spieth v. Rory.
What's your beef with Sky?
No. They went for like, you know, the drama of five is never quite as effective as the drama of two. So, you know, to create, it was going to be Rory. Look at Rory did well for 2 days. Like he had two solid, he played very, very well for, you know, to come back on, you know, after going four down the first day.
It was amazing.
Sorry. So I'm not taking, and he's building up towards, he says he can't wait to get to the PGA and I've no doubt that that's true. But I, can you in your, really, with your hand on your heart, if Rory had gone through what Spieth went through up to 13, do you honestly believe that Rory has that in him right now to be able to do what he did? And I have to say, I don't think he does.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I will say though, I watched every single shot he hit on Friday. Like I recorded it and came and watched it. He's not far away.
I mean, it was amazing. He's amazing. And but did you see, like, I mean, in fairness, he chased a lot on Sunday. And when you're chasing hard, you're going to make some mistakes. Yeah. So I wouldn't at all be critical in that sense. But what I liked, I suppose, the takeaway was that he wasn't like, his head didn't drop and he was like, ugh, this is happening again. What he was more, you could see he was agitated and frustrated, but he was alert. Mm. He was really alert. And if that's a sign of things to come, then Rory fans are going to be thrilled.
Des Smith said on Monday Nights Off the Ball, we were talking, he says, he followed Rory actually for all of Sunday, which, you know, given what was going on with Spieth, was a poor choice, I would say. But there you go. It's only just one of the most historic, iconic rounds of golf you ever missed, Des. But
and you're hearing cheers from someone, and you're like, "What? What's going on? Yeah. What's going on?"
maybe it's at 15, you got to think, I might go back and have a quick look at what's going on here. But he was saying Rory's at 70%. That's where he is. And
all right.
I think that's a fair summation. Well, ultimately, my guesstimate for what's going on here with Rory, because you hear different rumours and how much he's able to practice or all this kind of stuff. I don't think he's able to practice all that much, or certainly as much as he needs to. And so he is trying to sharpen up through tournament golf. That's what he's trying to do here.
He also finished fourth in the Open.
But trying to sharpen up through tournament golf,
it's not.
It's more erratic. You know, you're going to have some quirky days. But I can still see him coming to Quail Hollow and really doing it. Can we move on to Peter Lorre?
Yes, we can.
Okay, so we're going to talk to Peter Lorre. That is on the way now. Well, hey, so nobody wants to know how the sausage is made, but this is one of those unavoidable examples. Peter Lorre has just texted. He cannot take the call.
Oh, which is, Peter.
You know, look, I'm sure he's got some.
Yeah, no, no,
this was slightly late notice, but
he's a busy man. Busy man, but come on.
Okay, so we'll catch up with Peter again. And actually, next week we're going to do. A few people tweeted us. There was an excellent piece on David Duval, the rise and fall, and then through his media career, the re-rise.
Yeah.
Of the Duval.
Do you remember his remarks at the Open when he won the Open?
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah.
What it did is awesome. All of a sudden, Robocop became a human being, but a very likable and thoughtful and reflective human being.
Yeah,
whereas
he's great. It seemed to prompt some kind of existential crisis for him winning that Open because it wasn't everything he had hoped it would be. So there was a really good piece where the journalist Ron, second name escapes me, he'll be on. We'll get him on the show next week. A good few of you tweeted us about the piece, and he shadowed him a little bit at Birkdale on, you know, as he was going about his business with Brandel Chamblee and Frank Nabilo and the boys. So he wrote an interesting piece about Duval. So that's on the way next week. Can we just finish up then? So we kind of talked Rory and Spieth, and that was, you know, there's only so much more to say about it. But the Men's Senior Open is on in Royal Porthcawl in Wales. And if that's a familiar sounding course to you, in 2014, Langer won there by 13 shots. Like, it was just scary stuff. And he's the favourite again, Langer.
Is he the winningest man in the seniors for majors ever?
I don't know for sure, but it's...
I think he's overtaken Jack Nicklaus. He's won twice this year, hasn't
he? So he's 11-8 favourite going into it. Couples is way back on 28-1.
Jesus. Wow.
The second favourite is 28-1, along with Miguel Angel Jimenez. Langer's 11-8.
And is Monty playing? Sorry, did you see, by the way, the mystery of where Monty was in Scotland? He was playing senior golf. He played 22, he's signed up to play 22 of 26 events this year, which is why he couldn't do any broadcasting.
Okay.
But he showed up on Sunday.
I had the Monty thing wrong. Monty's actually 7-1 second favourite, so that was...
Okay, sorry.
Because that just seemed absolutely ridiculous.
Yeah.
So Langer's...
Two-time major winner.
Yeah. So, like, what's going on with Langer's... I mean, really, it must be quite difficult for him because he's publicly been... I was going to say called a cheat, but here's Freddie Couples is talking about Langer's putting stroke. And so Langer, if you were to, you know, people will have seen Langer, but if you're looking at the TV and you're watching Langer recently, it could look to you like he's still anchoring the putter.
He brushes the shirt.
Yeah, his hand is that close to his chest. At times, you know, he says it doesn't touch his chest and he's not anchoring it, as we'll see. But Freddie Couples, for instance, so you're talking about a Hall of Famer here. A fellow major winner, a fellow, I guess, icon of the game. Couples, for instance, has said in Langer's case that it's so close, it's bothersome. Was the phrase he used? But you know, you're kind of calling him a cheat, so it's difficult for Langer. He's doing his press conference today, Fionn, and it came up. The whole situation, and here was his reaction.
I'm a man of integrity, and the last thing I want to do is break rules and be known as cheating or something. I mean, that's the very last thing I want to do. So I know when I'm anchoring and when I'm not anchoring, because I can feel my hand, you know, I hold it like this, right? I go sideways, you can see it. So when my knuckle is away from the body, I'm not anchoring, I'm not touching any part of my body, and I know I'm within the rules. What's even stranger is that I have conferred with the USGA rules officials, with the Champions Tour officials on a regular basis. I tell them what I'm doing. I ask them before I practice that way, and they wholeheartedly say you're within the rules.
It seems almost like a vendetta against you.
It's human to be jealous, let's put it that way, right? So if I was number 180 in the money list, I don't think anybody would be talking about it. But I've been number one the last few years on a regular basis. And now Scott McCarron has a lot of success as well. We're actually number one and two on the Champions Tour. So you're going to have people being jealous or whatever you want to call it. I don't know.
Came out fighting.
He did. He's every right as well. I mean, I was thinking... Before I heard the clip, because I hadn't heard that clip, I was thinking, why did the USGA or the Champions Tour just come out and make a determination one way or the other, shut everybody up? Mm. And sure enough, they have. I mean, if, as he says, he's conferring with them going, listen, tell me, And if they're saying you're fine, well, then maybe Fred Couples would be wise to shut up.
Mm. Like the most pertinent line there for Langer is, I know when I'm anchoring and yes. I know when I'm not.
Well, yeah, sure. But yeah,
that's difficult for the rest of us because you know when you're anchoring and know when you're not. But it's not always easy for us to know. And that's where you use Fred Couples' word of bothersome. But I trust Langer here, I have to say. I don't think he would risk besmirching his entire reputation by subtly cheating under the glare of everybody.
And we've also said it before, and I said it earlier on. I think he brushes his shirt. I know he brushes. I can see it.
Yeah.
But that's not the same as he's leaning the putter head or the thumb, you know, the edge of the thumb into his chest.
I've thought of the solution.
Go on.
Whether he likes it or not, and I think he'd probably be up for it, he has to wear skin-tight Under Armour as his t-shirt.
Sure.
Because if he's wearing a baggy t-shirt, but if he's a fit man, I'd say he'd look quite good in some skin-tight Under Armour and come out, and then you can see for sure he's not brushing his chest.
I'm with you, though. I mean, as much as I look at... I think Freddie Couples... I think Fred Couples should know better, because not even saying something as guarded, it's bothersome. Mm. He knows it's setting the cat amongst the pigeons.
Oh, yeah.
He knows he's effectively accusing him of cheating.
Yeah.
And you know, walk that one back, Freddie, because like if he says it's bothersome, he might as well say he's anchoring. He's 100% anchoring.
Mm.
And then, you know.
Yeah. So, we'll see how it goes. Final point or two.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, not a well-known pro, but he's been around a bit. Jared Lyle, the Australian, who, he lost his card a couple of years ago or last year. But he's been diagnosed with acute myeloid leukemia for the third time in his life. Mm. So he's had a recurrence of it again. He came back to the PGA Tour in 2014, played on a medical exemption, because I think he'd had a relapse in 2012, so they gave him a medical exemption, couldn't keep his card, and has just been diagnosed again. So, you know, it's always sad when, a guy in prime of his life, you know, so.
Yeah. No, wish him all the best. Yeah, for sure. In matters less important, the golf this week is the Canadian Open, as is tradition. Dustin Johnson is playing. He's the favourite.
Who's saying that he's still not right after his weird fall.
Yeah. No kidding.
I was looking at his and I was like, has anybody talked to you, Dustin, about how to play links golf? Anybody? Has anybody said to you, stop trying to flight the ball to the flag every single time?
I'd have to disagree. Like that, you can flight the ball a little bit at Birkdale. Like Johnson has proven his links credentials. Like,
yeah, sorry. But I just felt that, I mean,
I don't think that's the issue, honestly. Because, you know, he was thereabouts at Royal St. George's like 6 years ago now.
I feel bad now.
Pebble Beach has a...
All right.
Okay, sorry. All right. It takes a big man to just back down. I appreciate
just
it.
Just back down straight away and say, you know what, I'm craving. That's what I am.
Dustin Johnson, Butch was saying that Johnson is fine and now he just needs his brain to understand.
He said something about self-confidence, didn't he?
Well, he's sort of saying he needs... Well, I guess that's part of it, but he was saying the brain needs to learn that when actually it swings properly now, it's not going to hurt. If you've had an injury for a long time, you adjust your swing ever so slightly. Your brain is trying to protect you from the pain. And Butch's take was, well, he's now able to swing properly again and his brain is just holding back ever so slightly. I mean, I don't know. I don't know how... Who knows with Johnson? But he's 11-2, favourite still, at the Canadian Open. Matt Kuchar, there again. I think that's a sponsor's reason. I don't think Matt Kuchar would like to play again this week all that much. Charlie Hoffman, Bubba Watson is playing... Keegan Bradley playing, and down we go. And then the European Tour has the Porsche Open.
See, Bubba Watson hasn't eaten sugar in a year and a half.
Yeah, well, he hasn't eaten anything in a year and a half, by the looks of it. Unbelievably thin.
Mm.
Porsche opens in Hamburg. Charles Schwartzel is there. Patrick Reed is there. Alexander Levy, and the field kind of goes off a cliff a little bit then. These are always kind of strange weeks, the week after.
I can't watch golf after a major.
I'll be watching. I like the Canadian Open. It's a good tournament. Mm. Yeah, traditionally very, very good. And, well, I mean, next week, so we'll be talking Duval next week. But also, like, it's WGC week next week. And then we've got the USPGA hot in the heels. Like, you think of Rory in 2014 when he won at Hoylake, and then WGC and then USPGA. This is the sweetest part of the golf season, where everything is just rightly condensed. So before we know it, we're going to be sitting here in a week or so, and we're going to be on the precipice of, is Jordan Spieth going to do the career Grand Slam? I think he turned 24 in the last day or two.
Yeah, in the Thursday. Today's his birthday.
Happy today. Jordan Spieth.
Happy birthday.
Who turned up at a Randy Rogers Wade Bowen concert in Texas.
That's right.
And had a drink from the claret jug. I'm not familiar with Randy Rogers and Wade Bowen.
Country singers.
They're big in Texas.
Country. They're big, big country and western stars.
Yeah.
Mm.
This whole subsect of society that I just know nothing about. But I mean,
Texans generally.
Just Texans.
Yeah.
It's mad, really. You know, like, we really are such a dot, this country. If you're
beers and steers, my friend, beers and steers.
If you're big in Texas, you're like, you know,
you're American.
It's
that's what you are.
What? How many Ireland's? 15 Ireland's.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Just so huge. You could look over there and say, well, you know, not nationally famous. We're just big in Texas.
Biggest state in the union by a mile. Bigger than or is it Alaska's bigger? In landmass, but of the they call the lower 48. Texas is huge, but also Texas is not so much geographically, but it's America. You know, it's not for nothing that the Dallas Cowboys are called America's team. Mm-hmm. Nice little bit of marketing hype, but yeah. And so Jordan Spieth being a Texan, it kind of roots him right in the middle of the American heartland.
Yeah, he's amazing. I mean, I think he's my favorite player now by distance.
Yeah, me too.
We're pretty much done. Thanks for going to Media City, Manchester.
Nah, my pleasure.
It was a pleasure. Next week, we'll hopefully talk to you again, and we'll be previewing a WGC, and we'll talk about David Duval as well. We'll tweet out a link to that article. Cheers, Fionn.
Thanks, Joe. All my exes wear Rolexes, but I reside right here in Dardanelle, all picket down. Starter kit right here.